Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with the illustrious Jody Williams of Bouvette. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you for having me.
You were just recently on Julia Tertian's Radio Cherry Bomb show talking about this wonderful cookbook I have in front of me, Bouvette, The Pleasure of Good Food.
Yeah, it was a great afternoon with Julia and all the rest of Hannah Cavell.
It's stunning. I mean, this project is a culmination of so many different things that you've done, but there's something that's tied them all together. And I think it's not just your finesse, but your focus on making something that kind of neighborhood joint. You know, as bistros are, as your past projects have been, you care about entertaining and having someone over and sharing a meal with them. Let's kind of start from the beginning. And is that California, the beginning for you?
Yeah, would be pretty much the beginning, California.
Yeah, correct. I mean, what was life like? What did you eat, cook?
Well, I grew up, I was a kid in California, you know. So what most kids eat, you know, school lunches and nothing really great. I mean, I didn't really grow up in a garden patch or have some wonderful story. It was pretty just basic growing up kids, you know, bologna sandwiches and stuff like that. But I was always intrigued, and I always had a knack for food. It came easy to me. Even as a kid, I would cook for the family. I'd cook for my mom and experiment and play around. I was always in and out of the kitchen, so to speak. You know, I would make French toast for the whole neighborhood if I could.
Yeah.
But nothing great. But I set my sights on traveling and teaching myself how to cook. Then I got exposed to a lot of really great things in life.
Yeah. I mean, in the book itself, you call yourself a self-taught chef. Mm-hmm. What is this culmination of experiences? Did you go formatively to school? Or what was your path into the culinary arts?
Well, I studied history in college, but I wasn't sure I would be a chef. I just always had after-school jobs. I always worked with food. I remember the first time I really started to learn how to cook. I was making sandwiches in a snack bar in a health club, and the chef used to come in a little tipsy, Mare, and she couldn't get her work done. And we didn't want Mare to get in trouble with the bosses, so we'd all pitch in and do Mare's mise en place, do her job. So I learned how to cook through that experience, and she would wake up in the middle of her shift and yell at me for not peeling apples for the salad right or anything like that. So I fell into it through a lot of ways, and that led me to this, to creating a place that you want to hang out in.
Absolutely, and I hang out in there plenty. And I'm only hoping to get to Pigalle soon to, you know, see that dichotomy of what New York and Paris have done, you know, to translate Bouvette. But going back again, it's not often that I read a foreword, you know, in a cookbook and feel such depth to it. And Mary Batali wrote a little piece about how the two of you have had very similar paths in the sense that you've been in the same places at the same times.
It's true.
Let's talk about the, you know, Clift House in San Francisco, that Four Seasons Hotel.
Right. Well, yeah, the Cliff Hotel with the famous Redwood Room. Mario had already been a sous chef there for some time, and I finished college, and I was looking for an experience in a kitchen to see if that's something I wanted to pursue, besides, you know, my after-school jobs and whatnot. So I found an ad to this job in the newspaper. I always do that. And I asked the porter, the doorman, I said, what does a steward do? He said, a steward puts food on plate. I said, oh, I got that. So I go around the corner, I go into the employee entrance, and I applied for the job, and I got the job, and then I'm in a lab coat, and I'm assistant steward and learning to set up banquets. And it was a rough job, you know. I mean, it's not the choice job you want to pick, right? Chief dishwasher. But Mario was in the kitchen, and passionate as ever about food, and there were a lot of great cooks and chefs in the restaurant, too, in the hotel. So I had a great experience there, but knew I really wanted to learn how to cook, so I got on a plane and came out to New York and set my sights on the next thing.
Reggio Emilia.
Yeah, well, Reggio Emilia, I fell into it. When I got a little experience in New York, and I began to teach myself how to cook, and I could hold down a job almost, and from there I went to Italy, and I stayed in Reggio Emilia. And I didn't know how long I was going to stay. I was just sort of, I'm blowing with the wind for my whole life.
Yeah. What is that area of Italy like?
Well, it's quite famous for pasta and food, and it's where they make prosciutto from Langriano, Parma, Parmigiano-Reggiano, balsamic. So it has a really rich culinary heritage, and it's a lot of fun. Real laid back in the middle of the Italy, so you're not on either, you don't really have access to either coast. But a short drive out to the seaside at Tuscany, not too far from Milan. You know, it's a great place.
It's homey.
And who's complaining?
Yeah.
No one's complaining about Venus.
You know, you mentioned those ingredients, Parm, you know, prosciutto, balsamic. Mm-hmm. They're such pantry ingredients. But what makes them different there than what we see in most American pantries?
Well, just keep in mind, I mean, if going to the source for just about anything that you want to teach yourself is an ideal situation to be in, because you get there and then that is their Parmigiano. So you learn more about it. You'll see it in different stages, when it's aged, the Stravecchio. It's more intense experience. And those ingredients are probably more choice in their pantries than ours. But our pantries are pretty grand these days.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that they're pretty staple items, but 10 or 15 years ago, they weren't. I mean, 10 or 15 years ago, mozzarella was sort of exotic around on certain tables. So we've really made some advances where we, you know, have all these ingredients at our fingertips, and plus all the knowledge.
Well, I mean, let's go back 10, 20 years in New York. What were you seeing on tables? I know you worked at, Raquel, Thomas Keller's restaurant.
Right.
What were those dishes?
Well, that was really probably one of the most popular restaurants at that time. What time was that? I'm talking about 1980. Yeah, about 1989, 87, 88. I don't know, you know. We were doing $35 lamb entrees. I mean, a lot of the food hasn't changed too much. I mean, that was very sort of continental French, very creative. You know, we were airbrushing gelatins on plates. Very intense kitchen, and a great experience for me. But I think the more laid-back Italian approach was appealing.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that at that time, because that's all I was learning was classical French, this kind of restaurateur. So, you know, like I say, rolling stone.
Yeah.
Picking it all up.
I mean, what do you consider laid-back Italian?
A laid-back Italian? Well, a laid-back Italian would be something for me that I would recognize, an experience I might have at a table with friends or having dinner at someone's house or going to a sagra or a festival outdoors where food's more shared and less formal. And, you know, I would say that kind of environment.
So, I mean, what were some of the dishes you were putting out at Reggio Emilia?
Reggio Emilia, we did classic Italian cuisine.
Yeah.
I did all the meats. I did all the proteins and the vegetables. And then the chef, he did all the pastas and risottos. You know, handmade tagliatelle, arancine, real classic cappelletti and brodo. I mean, the art of making brodo or the art of making a ripieno, a feeling for tortelli di zucca, one of my favorite things in the world. You know, it's intense to see it happen every year where the crop of pumpkin comes in, and whether it's watery or it's right or it's the best ever. It's food is very contemplative, but informal, but taken care of.
I like that you ping back and forth between classic and, you know, the art of, as if they're two different things, but they are the same, you know, the same vein, in that if you're trying to make a classic dish, you're trying to learn the art of that dish.
Right.
how does that translate to a restaurant? You know, you can make a croque monsieur for yourself, but how do you make it for everybody else and make it that signature thing?
Well, I think, croque monsieur, great. That's a great, let's see, how would I describe that? I think if you make any dish in your restaurant, it helps a lot to really love that dish, crave that dish, want that dish, respect it, and make sure you give it its due. So when I'm making your croque monsieur, your croque madame, I'm worried. Does it have enough ham? Did the bechamel come out? What's, you know, is the cheese melting? I mean, it gets complicated, and it's that love to execute it and make it what it deserves, you know, to wear its crown, so to speak, on any dish, whether it's two-minute egg, you know, that passion of getting it right, you know, how good it is when it's just right.
I mean, does that come more out of Italian or your newfound love of Gaelic food?
Well, I think you find it in anything. It's a universal thing. Any cuisine or any, you know, project or work you might have in mind, you know, that passion to tweak it, get it right, to study it, to learn from others, to make it your own and get it out to everybody. It's hard, you know. Cooking is very easy and very hard to do it professionally and, you know, get all the corners, you know, squared up.
Yeah, I mean, it's
at least for me.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's a consistency thing, and I've kind of followed your career in that. I loved Mirandi.
Oh,
I love Gotino, and you know, the things that you did were so warm and inviting, unfussy, but obviously so technical. And with Bouvette, it's kind of hit a straightaway. You know, you got to this point where I don't remember a time when Bouvette didn't exist, and I can't foresee a time when Bouvette won't be there.
Well, thank you. I like your thoughts. We have a lot of fun at Bouvette. And what makes Bouvette such a great place to hang out, to come and eat and visit, is the whole community that shows up. I mean, it really feels like, you know, a piazza, a community where you can drop in. No reservations, not necessary. Come and do what you want, you know. So we really try to, and I know there's long lines and people are waiting and everything. No, you know, it was meant from the very beginning. We built a place, you know, I built a place I want to hang out in myself with people. Not a lot of rules. I don't want to jump through a lot of hoops. I mean, you might have to stand and wait, but other than that, grab a table and do what you want.
If that's the least you have to do to have a croque monsieur there and, you know, a cure royale, I'm fine with that. You know, and what does the word Bouvette mean to you?
Bouvette, you know, in the classic sense, Bouvette is that place where you refresh yourself, where you, you know, grab a beer at a soccer game or gelato at the beach, you know, but it's a place to hang. For me, it's a place to hang out and think seriously about food and drink and just enjoy, you know.
And unlike many kind of New York spots, it's open all day. I mean, it's there to service the neighborhood almost first and foremost. It's not just about having a dinner rush. It's about being there.
Yeah, I think it's important to be open early and be open late. I mean, there's so many different New Yorkers, early morning and late night, and it's a legit community out there, and the door's open, you know, for everybody. I know a lot of restaurants, you know, to close early, you know, but really, New York's, it's happening late night, early in the morning, and it's great to be part of that.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, come back, talk more about the pleasures of good food with Jody Williams. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org.
doesn't want to be VIP? If you buy your Mac or iPad with AppleCare at TechServe, you're automatically enrolled in their excellent Insider Program. The Insider Program gets you free lessons, annual tune-ups, special offers, and more. Plus, you get discounts on some items and front-of-the-line privileges when new Mac products come out. It's one of the many reasons to make TechServe your one-stop shop for all things Mac-related. TechServe. Make stuff happen. For more, visit techserve.com.
Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Here today with Jody Williams of Bouvette, of the cookbook Bouvette, The Pleasure of Good Food. And, you know, we were talking during the break about which recipes I liked of the book, and I instantly said aligot, which is not really a well-known potato recipe, but charmed me years ago in France. In a similar vein, it seems like it charmed you. But tell me about the development of that recipe and kind of a chance encounter of a patron who came and cooked in your kitchen.
Well, once in a while, I'll use a chalkboard with just one word in the window. You know, just it's aligot or oxtail or bibonade. And this day it said aligot, and a lady burst in the door and said, "I'm from where they make aligot. How can you be making aligot? I know you, you know. And how are you making aligot? And show me your aligot." And this is wonderful. I love when this happens. And this is how I learned to cook, is a lot of this verbal tradition where I'm going to tell you everything I know, and you're going to share with me what you know and what you're passionate about, and it boils down to a good pot of soup, so to speak. Whether I would be in markets or fish stalls and ask somebody, what do you do with that fish? I always get a story and a good idea. I'm very practical, you know. So she came in and we discussed aligot, and I learned a lot from her. I'm like, okay, I got it.
Yeah. What you did know? She do that you weren't doing?
Well, it's traditionally made with a fresh cantal, a tome, and that's not really available out here. So you find the next best cheese that you can use to make that aligot. You said it's a potato recipe, and I'm thinking, gee, it's a cheese. I'm thinking it's a cheese recipe.
Yeah.
But, you know, half and half, and just the technique and the experience of it, where it's so much potatoes and so much cheese whipped together that it stretches for, like, feet, and as you wind it around your spoon and begin to serve it. So, you know, she just verified everything I was thinking and clarified how much I don't know at the same time. So, you know, always much appreciated. When people just walk in the door, just you get a letter out of the blue, and you take it, life takes a twist.
Yeah, I mean, it did take a twist in that you opened up a French bistro in New York, a gastrotech, as you call it, and then you were lured back to the motherland, to Paris, to open up, in a sense, a carbon copy of what you've done here. I mean, how many Americans have opened up a French bistro in New York only to export it back to Paris?
We didn't really, you know, that's really, we didn't think of it like that. I mean, if you told me that, I'm like, oh, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Wow. But, you know, I had a great guy, Thomas Gardez, working with me for a year. He walks in the door, wants a job, wants to work only in the mornings. Doesn't have any restaurant experience, so I said, listen, if you want to come tomorrow, 6 a.m., I'm washing the floor. We just opened, and that's what you do when you own a restaurant. So he showed up, and for a year we worked together. We had a great rapport, and he learned everything. I mean, so many people start out, like, you know, at the very bottom of the ladder. He learned everything. We taught him how to cook, how to manage, how to, you know, receive goods and whatnot. He really liked it, and I made a promise. Let's do this. We had so many French people coming in New York City, loving Bouvette, and saying, why don't you do this in Paris? What are you talking about? Where are you going? I know where I'm going when I'm in Paris. Yeah. What are you talking? So we were encouraged by the spirit of what was going on in New York. And here we had this little community of like minds. Then we met other people in Paris who, God, I love Bouvette. Let's do it. So there was an old Indian restaurant that we turned over into a Bouvette, and it's the same. It's the same thing, you know, and functions the same way, and it's over there now.
Yeah, does that kind of blow your mind?
Well, I don't think of it like in such a big picture kind of way. You know, it's a small neighborhood place with really special people who are on this adventure with me and risking it and learning it as we go. And in terms like that, it's really cool.
Yeah,
and it's a great commute. and I'm having a blast. And it seems to be working and being well received. And for someone who's self-taught, I'm learning more and more every time I go over there.
Yeah, where do you eat aside from Bouvet while you're in Paris?
Oh, I love old classic things. You know, I mean, I go everywhere I can. I mean, unstoppable. But anywhere I can go. But I like old traditional things. Fontana de Mars, Chez George, you know, long lunches. But, you know, markets, hang out at markets.
Yeah, which markets?
Well, the market, we're in Pigalle, in the South Pigalle there, so... we go to Bagnoles, the market at Bagnoles, which is our closest market on Saturdays. And Linda, who is our partner and landlord there, she knows everything, and she's a great guide. I mean, you can eat raw oysters there and get our cheeses and special jams and apple cider in the fall. So it's just a great environment and inspiring for me as a chef and continuing the opportunity to learn stuff. Stuff.
Yeah. I mean, well, the stuff that you've learned, again, back to the classics, I mean... It's cassoulet, it's poulet rôti. I mean, it's tried and true traditions. How does it differ in, you know, New York versus Paris?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of differences, and there's a lot of similarities. A few differences for me as a chef. They have great poultry, excellent poultry, and excellent ingredients. So when you make coq au vin, you're really making, you know, it's the chicken cooks longer, you know, the butter is just more rich, the crema fraiche is just out of this world. And why we're finding great ingredients here too in New York, there's a slight difference, you know, you have to pay a little bit of attention.
Yeah. Then do you tweak your recipes, do you tweak your technique so there's a consistency between the two bistros, or do you let it be its own thing?
I probably tweak stuff every day, you know, but we tweak a little bit in Paris, and we allow for a lot of localism, what's going on there, what people are interested there, what we pull from the markets. I mean, I heard cherries were out last week already, and here I'm in New York City, so we're on a little bit of a different time schedule.
Yeah.
So taking that in consideration, and we're all on, different kitchens are on different learning curves, but it's pretty much the same thing, same spirit. I mean, when we got there, we weren't really going to put Bouvet on the door. We just... wanted to make this place to hang out, you know, and some people popped their head in and said, they said in French, oh my God, is this the same Bouvet in New York? And we looked at each other and said, oh my God, who knew? You know, we didn't think anybody would ever know.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, I'll be back tonight with my friends. We looked at each other, and I had with me, you know, Max and Mark from New York, you know, and we went out and painted the name. Mark went out and painted the name on the door.
Yeah. It's kind of an amazing thing, you know, that you've created something that is the best of everything. And people understand that and accept it and want it as close to them as possible. Is there another city? Are there other places in the world that are hoping for or getting a Bouvet?
Well, you know, it's a very intimate group of people. So as that circle widens and, like... I have colleagues that we work together in Tokyo. That could be a possibility. We're exploring that. We have invitations. You know, we have invitations. But we like doing it, you know, with each other, for each other. And it's a strange thing. It's not. This is definitely not a business model. But you can never say no. But we're, you know, why not?
Yeah. You know, and as French as Bouvet is, I love the little idiosyncratic Italian things that creep back in. Because you can't get rid of your past. And it's such a wonderful thing to have in your repertoire. But, you know, does it have to be traditionally French to be in Bouvet? Seemingly, no.
No, you know what? We have one rule. And it's do what we love.
Yeah.
And if we want BLT sandwiches, homemade mayo and crisp iceberg lettuce, nice toast, we're going to make it. And I think it's that drive, it just keeps it really fresh, you know. But I personally love classics, and I love learning more and more about things, you know, more classic dishes. But it's meant to be fun. And that's why you'll find a lot of highs and lows on the menu. If you're in Paris, you could order a bottle of Krug or have a can of 1664. Because you mentioned it's about, you know, the best, but that's so subjective,
mm-hmm.
you know. and every day is different. So to be a place that's so part of a community, it's great to have highs and lows.
Well, I think I meant the best in ideology because, you know, good coffee is a must. You don't serve decaf. You don't serve sweeteners. You just told me you don't serve Coca-Cola anymore. That there's a very, you know, specific way you want to cater to your audience. And it is by delivering the best experience. So by having that wide net, you know, and everything on that net being immaculate is, in my eyes, the best way of doing things.
I think it's important to edit ourselves and sort of weed out. I mean, basically, I have a really small place, and I can't have everything. So we have to edit ourselves out. And we try to think of one thing when we have to make decisions. And that one thing is this good for our guest? And it could have to do with how many waiters we have on the floor, or whether we're going to serve this or that. What does it mean for the guest? I think as long as we keep that in mind and that's our focus and we do what we love, we're going to be okay.
Talk to me about Oofs Brûlées.
Oofs Brûlées?
Yeah.
Steamed eggs.
I love it. I love it so much.
That's so funny. I'm just a very lucky person. I mean, I said, you know, I was a cook for a long time and I knew if I was ever going to have my own place, which was a daily dream, I used to tell my friends I'd have to cook off an espresso machine and a panini press because that's probably all I could afford, you know, on a salary that for chopping onions all day. So I did. And it happened to be a great technique for steaming eggs. What I'm talking about is we crack a couple fresh eggs into a porcelain pitcher, stir them, and apply the steam wand on an espresso machine so that they sort of bloom and soften. And serve them over toast with Parmesan or fresh prosciutto or smoked salmon, creme fraiche, the classic things you'll find at Bouvet. And we do that all day. We do it with caviar, and we serve other little things. So basically, this idea that Bouvet is a gastrotech and all the food comes right in front of you behind the bar, as well as we're prepping in the kitchen all day. We have a little kitchen where we're, like, peeling fava beans and prepping and, you know, washing dishes.
You know, you say it from right behind the bar, and one of my favorite things is when you walk in, right to your left, at the end of the bar, there always sits a tarte de thym.
Right.
You know, and it because you also just mentioned something I don't know if you realize. You said a classic at Bouvet, and I feel like you've already done that for yourself, already developed classics in your own restaurant off of other people's classics, that if people walked in there and that tarte de thym wasn't there that day, they'd be sad.
Yeah, this is interesting part of cooking for me, because I thought for a long time that I'd write a menu every day. I'd want to start over and maybe elements of that remain. But I'd start over and have another menu, and I thought that's what it was. And then I realized that people wanted things, and they were very comfortable when the place had an identity and they had an expectation. And I realized that's true about myself, that I'll travel across town to get A, B, or C. And if it wasn't there, I'd be a little disappointed. So we try to cook within this identity that we have for ourselves, and people have anointed things on the menu, the guests have, that are now classics.
Yeah.
And things we do at Bouvet are sort of iconic. And I realize how important that is, and I try to honor it, take care of it. You know, appreciate it.
What were some of the dishes that you, I think, didn't expect to be Bouvet classics?
I'm taking the French classics and just making it. So, I mean, I'm already coming off a classic status when you talk about chocolate mousse and tarte tartan. But I love when people say, can I have a dessert menu? I'm like, no dessert menu, just two things.
Yeah.
Tarte tartan and chocolate mousse. But what surprises me to be a classic, everything's sort of already a classic thing. I mean, I'm surprised that people ask for, you know, like rabbit moutarde and lots of cassoulet, and that they're still eating, you know, pots and pots of coq au vin. I'm very pleased, but I'm overall impressed that things are always requested. You know, kids coming in after school with their parents for, you know, chocolate crepes, Nutella crepes.
I mean, it's become... I'm trying to think of a new word because it's not a destination because it's there already. You know, it's embedded in the West Village, if not the greater New York and now Paris. So it's this establishment that exists. Part of that existence is not just the food, but how well designed the place is and how well designed the menu is. You know, and when you think about aesthetic, I mean, your steamed artichokes in the cookbook are such a beautiful thing. Do you work from the aesthetic first?
I don't think we really think in terms of aesthetic. I like things to have a certain feel for it. And I like things to sort of represent what they are. It's very easy, you know. It's sort of super normal. There's a lot of super normalism. You know, and I'm happy to be here and always embarrassed when it gets pointed out so often that, yeah, it's just a lot of normal stuff, but really cared for and loved, you know. So when you talk about design, it's an opportunity for us to play. I mean, what's great about Bouvet and being a gastrotech is sort of, is a restaurant that's inside out. So we're able to do things that most restaurants can't do because it's just the sleek nature of the setup. So we have time, we can play with paper, we can play with letterpress, we can enjoy developing, you know, we paint the menu on the window. It's sort of, we're sort of unfettered there in a way.
And how many people steal your menu, which is one of the cutest, most charming little things.
Our pop-up menu.
Yeah.
I don't know. I hope they don't steal that much. You can always ask for one.
Yeah.
You know, people enjoy it. I know when Martha Stewart walked in, it was like the first thing. She started snapping pictures of the pop-up menu, you know.
And explain what the pop-up menu is.
Well, it's just a little menu. It has a little icon that represents Bouvet in the middle of it. So when you open the pages, it sort of pops up. So sort of like a 3D menu. And we make these by hands there, right? We glue them together, right? So it's endless work. There's a million tasks to do. Are you not busy? Come over here. Put the rivets in the wine list. Oh, you got time? Let's go, you know, fold a million napkins. But it's just fun. It's just more in the spirit to play with things and being inspired by, you know, children's books or looking at the monotony of doing what we do every day and being able to refresh ourselves and find another different way to do something. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, I'm always excited to see what that slightly different way is. And when I tell people, you know, go stop by Bouvet, see Jody, like you see Jody there, not just the aura of, but it's a pretty exposed restaurant. You see the bones. But in the best of ways, because that's what, you know, brings people in. And that's what's so amazing and charming about it. And this cookbook as well, Bouvet, The Pleasure of Good Food. Just such a great culmination of everything that you've done. And I see it, again, riding for a long time. I can't wait for my next stop in.
Well, thank you very much.
And for my next croque monsieur. Just everything there. It's on my mind's racing about what I'm going to order next. But I'm just going to be happy to see that tarte de tan at
the end
of the
bar. Well, you've got the book right there.
I do. I'm
going to
start cooking away. Absolutely. Thank you again, Jody. And if you want to learn more about the cookbook, again, listen to Radio Cherry Bomb, Julia Tertian's interview with Jody Williams. Fantastic. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.